Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for June 29th, 2010. I'm Annalisa VanHook, and today I'm speaking with Christopher Howe about the evolution of the target of rapamycin, or TOR, signaling pathway. In today's issue of Science Signaling, his group reports their survey of TOR signaling components across a broad range of eukaryotes. Eukaryotes are those organisms that have membrane-bound cellular organelles, and they include animals, fungi, and plants. They then use this analysis of the TOR pathway to evaluate current theories of the earliest branching events in the eukaryotic family tree. Dr. Howe joined me on the phone from the University of Cambridge, and I first asked him, what is it about the TOR pathway that makes it such an interesting target for evolutionary studies?
Well, the simple answer to that is that it's a very important pathway and very important for a lot of aspects of cell metabolism. But I suppose, like a lot of things in science, I actually got involved in it through a series of coincidences. And I was talking to a clinician friend of mine, Petrus de Vries, who works on a condition called tuberous sclerosis, or TSC. And that's a very interesting genetic disorder that causes tumors in a range of organs. And the genes involved, TSC1 and TSC2, were identified a few years ago, and the proteins turn out to be part of a really important signaling pathway in mammalian cells that also involves a protein called TOR, which stands for target of rapamycin. And listening to people talking about these, I was struck that people in papers and at meetings and things always said this pathway is conserved throughout eukaryotes, which usually means that they can find components of it in yeast and Drosophila and mice and humans. Now, as an evolutionary biologist, I get very cross when people say things like that, because actually yeast, Drosophila, mice and humans all belong to just one of a number of evolutionary groups. So we thought it would be very interesting to see just how widely distributed this pathway was. And so we got together with another clinician, Jaco Serfontein, and an evolutionary biologist, Ellen Nisbet, to do just that and to try and map in some detail the components of the pathway.
What groups of eukaryotes did you survey for TOR pathway components?
So we surveyed the major groups of eukaryotes, of which there's five or six, depending on exactly how you classify them and who you talk to. So we surveyed a group called the opisthokonts, which includes you and me and fungi and so on, and a closely related group called the amoebozoa, and that includes slime molds, includes entamoeba, which is a very nasty intestinal parasite. And then the other ones that we looked at are a group called Archaeplastida, which is plants and green algae and red algae, a group called the excavates, which includes a number of very nasty pathogens as well, Giardia, Leishmania, Trypanosoma. And then finally, a group called the chromalvulates, which includes seaweeds and, interestingly, includes the malaria parasite, Plasmodium, which turns out to be, surprisingly, closely related to photosynthetic organisms.
Why is the TOR pathway in particular a pathway that's likely to be very highly conserved?
Well, the pathway is linked to a number of things within cells. One of the things that it's linked to is energy levels, and it allows cells to couple growth and development and division and so on to energy levels. And that's really a pretty fundamental thing for cells to be able to do. And it's not unreasonable to think that it probably evolved quite early on in evolution of the eukaryotic organisms. So that's why it was particularly interesting to look at and see if it was just as important as we thought it might be.
So TOR pathway components are not present in prokaryotes, the bacteria and the archaea?
That's correct, yes. So this seems to have been something that evolved very early on after the eukaryotes separated off from the prokaryotes. And probably the reason that was important was because the eukaryotes had really just established themselves and established themselves with mitochondria, that was this really novel way of cells being able to make energy, to make ATP. So it's probable that it was actually evolutionarily quite advantageous for them to be able to develop a way of coupling the kinds of things that they wanted to do, growth and division and so on, to this novel energy source that they hadn't otherwise quite got used to. You know, it's like having a new lodger, as it were, I suppose, just kind of getting used to this new thing in the cell, the mitochondrion.
How much does the complexity of the pathway and the topology of the TOR pathway vary in organisms that are present today?
The central parts of it are quite similar. So there are a few key bits that are involved in signaling and control in response to energy levels that are very widespread. And then what's happened is that in different lineages, different bits of the pathway or different additional bits have been bolted on, as it were, to provide for the needs of those particular groups. So if you look in plants, for example, there's some very interesting data just coming out showing that the pathway is also involved in cell wall biogenesis and the control of cell wall biogenesis. And obviously, that's something that plants need to do. We don't need to do because we don't have cell walls. So there are extra bits in different lineages that have been tacked on according to the needs of those particular lineages.
What groups have the most basic version of the TOR pathway?
Well, the basic version that really has a thing called AMPK, that's a kinase that responds to levels of AMP, have that and a protein called RAPTOR and TOR and then something that they modulate, S6 kinase, which is involved in protein synthesis. That bit of the pathway is present throughout everything, as far as we can tell. And then there are extra bits that you find in particular lineages. So, for example, the TSC1 and TSC2 proteins that I mentioned at the start, those proteins are actually present just in a particular group that we call the opisthokonts.
What sorts of organisms are opisthokonts? What defines these organisms as a group?
Well, it includes a range of organisms, includes things like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, so fungi, and also includes animals like Drosophila, and then going on up to vertebrates, including mice and humans and so on. So to most people, it actually seems a really pretty broad group of organisms, which is why people often tend to equate it with eukaryotes generally. But there's a whole load of other eukaryotes out there that don't fall into that group, like, for example, plants, algae, and so on.
The study informed you about evolution of the TOR pathway in terms of how the TOR pathway changed throughout evolution. But in looking at evolution of the TOR pathway, did that teach you something about eukaryotic evolution?
I think it has, because there's a lot of controversy about the actual order in which these different eukaryotic groups diverge from each other. And if you look at most people's idea of an evolutionary tree showing these eukaryotic groups, they basically have the groups kind of radiating out from the center, from the root, if you like. But right by the root, there's a big question mark because people argue about what the order of divergence of these groups is, what is the most fundamental evolutionary divergence. And I think because signaling pathways are very fundamental for how cells work, then actually they may be quite useful as an evolutionary indicator that will help us to understand where the root, the most ancient part of the eukaryotic tree, is. And our study has suggested that, and one wants to be cautious about overinterpreting this, but the indications are that the root is between a group that we call the archaeplastida, that's to say plants and red algae and green algae and everything else, and that possibly one of the most important evolutionary divergences within the eukaryotes was into those organisms that could do photosynthesis and those organisms that couldn't do photosynthesis. That's a conclusion that not everybody agrees with, I have to say. You know, there are a number of other models out there that other people have put forward as to where the root, the earliest divergence of the eukaryotic tree is.
Members of the Archaeplastida aren't the only eukaryotes to have chloroplasts, the organelles that are required for photosynthesis. The chloroplasts in Archaeplastida are the product of primary endosymbiosis, that is, they developed from a cyanobacterium that was engulfed by an ancestor of the Archaeplastida. Members of other eukaryotic lineages, such as the brown algae, have subsequently acquired chloroplasts from the Archaeplastida in a process referred to as secondary endosymbiosis. In other words, the Archaeplastida developed chloroplasts first, and then members of other lineages acquired them from the Archaeplastida. I asked Dr. Howe if there were any modifications to the TOR pathway that were shared by both primary and secondary photosynthetic eukaryotes, if there were characteristics of the pathway that correlated with the gain or the loss of chloroplasts.
There seems to be an interesting pattern in relation to a protein called RICTOR, which is also part of the signaling pathway. And according to our model, RICTOR seems to have evolved after the photosynthetic plant and algal lineages diverged from the others, and it was evolved in the non-photosynthetic lineages. What seems to happen is that those non-photosynthetic lineages that subsequently acquired photosynthesis by the secondary acquisition of a chloroplast actually seem to have lost RICTOR. We can't find RICTOR there in those organisms. So what it may mean is that if you have a chloroplast then and could do photosynthesis, then RICTOR becomes unnecessary. That's a correlation at this stage, but it's quite an interesting one. It would certainly be very, very interesting indeed to follow up a bit more.
So phylogenetic analysis based on your TOR data rooted the eukaryotic tree between the Archaeplastida and those other groups. How does this agree with current hypotheses of early eukaryotic evolution, and how does it disagree? I know this is a very contentious topic, and it's a maybe not necessarily contentious, but it's certainly a topic of very active debate within evolutionary biology.
It certainly is. And I mean, I think it's true in evolutionary biology that the further back you go, and so probably the less confident you can be about your conclusions, actually the more dogmatically people tend to assert their conclusions. For some time, there was a view that the root of the tree was between the opisthokonts, that's you and me, lumped together with the amoebozoa, that's the slime molds and things, and everything else. And that first group is called the uniconts, and the everything else is called biconts. And that's to do with the number of flagella and so on that you find on the cells. So our sperm cells, for example, have a single flagellum, and that's consistent with our being uniconts. So for some time, there was a view that the root of the tree was between the uniconts and the biconts. And other sets of data have started to disagree with that to some extent. And our analysis indicates that the root lies within the biconts and probably lies between the Archaeplastida and everything else.
Why is this part of the tree of life so difficult to resolve? I mean, obviously, the kinds of cells that we're talking about, these ancestors, don't exist anymore. And even the things that we think about as basal eukaryotes, these protists, you know, they're not representative of the ancestor. They've been evolving this entire time just as we have. So I guess that contributes to why it's so difficult to look this far back in time at the base of the tree.
Yes, I think part of the answer is that the kinds of organisms that we look at are, as you say, not necessarily representative of their group as a whole. They're the ones that we can culture in the lab, or maybe that are serious human pathogens that we know a lot about. So the ones that we used in our study were basically ones which we have complete genome sequences. There's a lot of other organisms out there that we know very little about, and we may not be able to culture them, and so it makes them much more difficult to study. So one issue is the extent to which the organisms we're looking at are representative of what's out there. I think another argument as to why it's difficult to answer the question is that it really did happen so long ago. The origin of eukaryotes was probably of the order of 1.5 billion years ago, something like that. So there's a lot that's happened since then. There's a lot of possibility for example, lateral gene transfer when organisms that aren't particularly closely related can swap genes. The whole population has been through at least one so-called global snowball where the whole of the surface of the Earth was covered with ice, probably right as far as the equator. So that must have led to mass extinctions, which will also mean that some representative lineages have been lost and we'll never see them again. So there's a lot of factors together that make it actually quite difficult to understand some of those very early evolutionary events.
Well, thank you, Dr. Howe.
Pleasure.
That was Christopher Howe, corresponding author of a research article published in the June 29th issue of Science Signaling. That article is by Sir Fontaine and colleagues, and it's titled Evolution of the TSC1-TSC2 TOR Signaling Pathway. And that wraps up this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. This show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.